more cuts. And now the district has money. Lots of it.
Lots of money.
Don't want to continue taking rollbacks in our pay. We want to maintain the teaching profession as a middle class profession where families can afford to live on it.
Yeah, the last working class jobs that are living wage jobs, actually, they've been going at every other large group. Truckers no longer get. Teachers are the last place where you can start extracting billions of dollars for the hedge fund people.
Yeah.
Really, there's 3 million teachers in the United States. That's a lot of money to
grab.
That's
right.
Anyway, that's another story which we can get into another time. Let's talk about why the teachers in Portland, it wasn't about wages and benefits. The district wanted to cut them. Their original contract offer was very deep cuts.
Yeah.
The teachers only wanted to protect it, which they basically did in the contract.
I believe so, yeah.
That's what it appears.
Yeah, so what teachers, I think, really have felt in this contract is that we want to maintain or increase our ability to do our jobs well. We came into this profession to be great teachers. We want to serve every child. We want every kid to reach their potential. And when our working conditions are diminished, when our class sizes get bigger, when resources are taken away from our schools, when we don't have counselors, when special education teachers have too many kids to be able to serve them well, none of us can do our jobs as well as we want to be doing them.
Yeah, let's get into the testing thing, too. They're imposing sort of a new Portland, less than most cities, actually, less than Chicago, less than New York. But doing it slowly, and the people on the school board really want to do it faster. The whole testing system, No Child Left Behind, and constant testing and testing prep. Tell us about that, as well as the curriculum.
Yeah, so since No Child Left Behind was passed, which was the first year of my teaching in 2003, there has been increasingly more and more standardized testing. And it's not only is it more time that kids are spending testing, which it is, but it's more and more emphasis being put on testing by the school district and then by principals, because things rely, our funding, our stature, our reputations rely pretty much only on this testing data.
The Oregonian just keeps saying, our test scores aren't high enough.
Yeah.
And we have to do something about these lousy teachers.
Yeah. And the reality is when our test scores get higher, they tend to change the benchmarks.
Oh, yes.
Which has happened several times in Oregon.
In the high schools, you're able to preserve, you have at least up to now, at least in Madison High School, that they don't care about as much as Wilson and Lincoln, is my sense. That's another problem. But you maintain, you teach English there, you maintain the authority to, in fact, assign novels and other things, ways of reaching students, things they may like, things that are really provocative and interesting to talk
Absolutely.
About.
Absolutely. Yeah, we do. And that's something that is deeply important to teachers, that we can decide what material to use with our kids, what books are going to reach them, what topics are going to make a real connection with them. And we do have that. And it's something that teachers would absolutely be up in arms about losing our autonomy. And I've seen at the elementary and middle school level, I think teachers are starting to lose quite a bit of that autonomy and being told to use the textbook only to teach reading or the textbook only to teach social studies, and denying kids the opportunity to find books and topics that they love passionately and that it's going to inspire them to keep on reading.
These textbooks also are dull, dull, dull.
They can be, yeah.
And a lot of them, I mean, in social studies, it's sort of the facts that they think will be on tests.
Yeah.
And all ideologically driven, incidentally, but that's a whole nother matter.
And then the big business of this is that the tests are designed by the same companies often that create the textbook. So it kind of creates a circular system.
And you have to then grind kids into the texts, and so that maybe they'll pass, that they'll do better on the test. Maybe not. They probably are going to do worse on the test because they don't learn anything really in those things.
I think that the companies like Pearson selling the tests and the textbooks would like you to believe that if you use the textbook, they'll be do better on the tests. But I agree with you that real learning happens when kids are fired up and doing reading things that they care about.
Yeah, none of the elite private schools.
No.
Would text any, would touch any of this stuff.
Absolutely.
The parents would be up in arms. You can't force our kids to rote memorize this nonsense.
Absolutely, it's, yeah. You know. No, I think that's really true. The same people making education policy are sending their kids to private schools where learning is about joy and freedom. And yeah, there's discipline and there's facts, but it's not something that is dominating the time. And those same people are making policies asking our kindergartners to be in seats doing memorization and multiple choice type activities instead of what's developmentally appropriate. Honestly, it might even help them to be better test takers. But as a parent, I'm pretty sure that's not what most parents dream about for their children, is to become better test takers.
Yeah. One final thing that seems to me the teachers have a really good reason to be angry about is the scapegoating of the public schools and the teachers and their unions. Like Diane Ravitch, who used to do that, suddenly realized the teachers are the heart of the school, and she became a radical, actually. But tell us about the scapegoating.
Well, so I think that the premise behind the No Child Left Behind law was that if teachers are held accountable for their children's test scores, they'll try harder, teach better, and then kids will all end up more successful. Logic and the facts will tell you that that's not the case. Children in poverty don't have low test scores because their teachers aren't trying hard enough. Children in poverty tend to have low test scores in the United States and every other country in the world because they don't have proper nutrition, because they don't have adequate health care, because they don't have stable homes, because they don't have parents with the time to sit and read to them every single day.
They don't have books in the home. They're constantly moving.
It goes on and on. They have stresses in their lives on a daily basis that prevent them from giving their full attention to school. Teachers and schools have a very important role in serving kids in poverty, but they cannot erase the effects of poverty. Single-handedly. We need to be putting resources into preventing poverty so that children can put their energy and their attention into the things we're trying to teach them at school.
Yeah, and the very people who create poverty, that is the big hedge fund types and the people who move jobs overseas, who help companies and reward CEOs for cutting wages of people. They're the very ones, the ones who create poverty, decided to blame the teachers for poverty.
Absolutely.
It's so infuriating.
So I think scapegoating is a perfect term for it. It's a way to take attention away from what the real problem is and blame it on teachers.
Right. This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Talking to Elizabeth Teal, who teaches in Madison High School, writes about the schools. She had a recent article in Labor Notes, and which has been republished in various places, and has two kids in the Portland public school system. Just as an aside, how is Vernon? Is it good for your kids?
My kids love school, and I think one of the things that I really value about it is that it's a very diverse school, and they get to interact with people that are like and unlike them in a lot of different ways. And it's a vibrant community, awesome parents. They love it.
Elizabeth, let's get back to the contract, the struggle about the contract. Mm-hmm. The contract, at least as it was a leak to the Oregonian, and no one really disputes this part, basically you saved your wages. And because they're allowing a small increase, probably going to be a little bit less, maybe a little bit more than the inflation rate. Basically, it stayed level, and the level is much lower than it was 10 years ago because you took all these cuts. So it really wasn't about wages and benefits. The key thing about the contract and the fight was about the teachers' demand to add more teachers.
Absolutely.
It's not clear that, in fact, you can bargain or strike under the law for anything except for wait. They're trying to completely restrict teachers, take away all power. All they can bargain about is wages and benefits. Well, you demand that we're going to go out and strike unless you add more teachers. You have a lot more money now, no more consultants, no more administrators. You've cut the schools so badly, we want more help.
Yeah.
And smaller class sizes. That was really what this fight was about.
It is.
And you won it.
I think so. I haven't seen the official word, but if the leak is right and that if PPS is adding 150 teaching positions next year, that is a huge victory. That the one thing that will help teachers to either consider this a victory or a loss is if our schools are starting to add back what our kids need. And I just want to be clear, we can't strike over class size, but we can over workload. Class size is our workload. Having 35 kids in your class is a lot more work than having 25 kids in a class. And so by adding teachers, we are asking for reduced workload. And reducing workload on teachers means increasing learning conditions for students.
Right. It's not really decreasing workload. You're still working all the time.
It's not increasing our work time. It's allowing us to do our jobs better.
It's allowing you to actually interact with students.
Yes.
That's one of the right-wing agenda, incidentally, is to have more classes where the kids and you have 100 of them in a room look at a computer.
Yeah.
And you don't hire teachers, you hire security personnel.
Right.
So to make sure that the kids aren't fighting. The teachers don't, these security personnel don't do anything. There's no interaction with the kid, there's no training. All it is watching to make sure that nobody gets
right.
hurt. And that's their model of a school, actually, more and more, less and less actual personal relationship.
Yeah.
These are with children, too, our teenagers
right.
who need.
And to bring it back to what you mentioned earlier, that's the opposite of what's happening in elite private schools.
Yes.
And that's the opposite of what the high tech execs in Silicon Valley who invent and create and sell these devices want for their children.
It's really insidious in a lot
yeah.
of ways. But those people actually, it just shows that the best and the brightest are extremely stupid. It's the destruction of, in fact, the sort of American intellectual capacity, what they're doing
yeah.
to people.
I think that it's really just based on markets and profit
right,
and
right.
looking for ways to, instead of paying middle-class teachers to interact with kids and give them a real human education, corporations can make a whole lot more money if instead we're putting the money yeah. into electronic devices.
Right. And then they come to believe it, though, of course, because it's this echo chamber and they talk to one another and they hire people to flatter them and to flatter their ideas.
Yeah.
They're not really challenged by anything. They've managed to insulate themselves from any kind of critique. So they're going to keep fighting.
Right.
The question is, how do we maintain that sort of teacher-parent power towards the reconstruction less of the high school class curriculum because they haven't really destroyed you yet. it's coming. I mean, they're moving in that direction. And class loads keep getting bigger.
Right.
And you have less counselors, less art, less theater, less anything that would.
Right.
There are many intelligences. People can excel in lots of things. The more things you have to excel in, the more students who are going to get interested and excel, including
mm-hmm.
athletics and all the things that
yeah.
they're cutting. Let's talk about, instead of that kind of the education that the Arne Duncans of the world and,
yeah.
and then the Bloombergs and the Rahm Emanuels in Chicago want, testing, and
yeah.
the rest. Let's talk about what teachers and parents and students, the student union was terrific, what can they fight for?
Well, I think that the high-stakes testing is the issue that I think that we really need to mobilize around. And I know in New York State, there's been huge mobilization around standardized testing. And I think around the country, teachers need to see themselves as the voice that needs to defend public education. I don't think when most of us came into teaching, we thought that public education was going to need defending, especially against laws like No Child Left Behind that are really set up to characterize schools as failures and then privatize them. But in the reality that we're facing right now, I think teachers need to have the confidence that it is our job. We do have the right, and in fact, I think we have the responsibility to talk about what's going on in our schools, let parents know what's going on now, and an alternate vision of what things can be so we can work together. And I think that was key to organizing in Portland, was working alongside parents and students and having the same message to the school district. We all want smaller class sizes. We all want a wraparound services and rich curriculum added back. And I think if we are able to continue organizing together with our whole community, that in here in Portland, Oregon, I really hope that we can take our education back and have a real dialogue about appropriate use of testing.
And do assessment, but do assessment of a very different kind, obviously.
Yeah.
And one final thing, though, it seems to me is really important. A good school has to have some good administrators
yep.
who really want to bring teachers together to mm-hmm. create a school culture that values learning. Unfortunately, many of the principals don't do that. They're a lot of petty tyrants. Not most of them. I think there are a lot of good principals in the system. Why don't you have the last word on that issue?
Yeah, so I think that principals have a huge role in creating a positive climate in a school and seeing the strengths in their teachers and allowing teachers to use those strengths to make the school strong. I think that when a principal sees their role as controlling and managing teachers, it tends to create a lot of conflict. When a principal sees their role as shepherding teachers to use their strengths, to collaborate with each other, to problem solve what's going on in the school, to bring issues in front of teachers and say, how do we solve this problem? Amazing things happen because teachers care deeply about the success of their school and are willing to work incredibly hard for it. I think what goes wrong is when principals see their role as holding down the teachers so that they don't get too powerful. So teachers and the community and students and principals, we all need to be working together to make education fit our vision for what we're trying to do for kids. We have incredibly talented and creative and devoted teachers, and with the resources that we need, we can make our schools excellent.
Elizabeth Teal, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thank you.
If you like the idea, though, you can help me out. If you love your Uncle Sam, bring him home, bring him home. Support our boys in Vietnam, bring him home, bring him home. It'll make our generals sad, I know. Bring him home, bring him home. They want to tangle with the foe. Bring him home, bring him home. Here is their big fallacy. Bring them home, bring them home. They don't have the right weaponry. Bring them home, bring them home. The world's got hunger and ignorance. Bring them home, bring them home. You can't beat that with bombs and guns. Bring them home, bring them home. So if you
That was an anti-war song called Bring 'Em Home by Pete Seeger. We'll be hearing more about Pete Seeger later in the program. You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. Well, that tireless old mole, Bill Resnick, is still standing by to take your calls at 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. It's always a great time to become a part of this great organization. Now, Larry Bolden, our fiction reviewer, is doing something a little different today. Rather than focusing on a single work, here's Bill to talk about the many great works of English novelist Anita Bruckner, winner of the Booker Prize and many other prestigious awards for her lifetime's work.
Good morning. Instead of my usual practice of reviewing a particular book this morning, I want to talk about and pay tribute to an incredible and prolific author, Anita Bruckner. I'll mention a number of her novels and will end by focusing briefly on her 22nd book, The Rules of Engagement, published in 2003. One of the first things that drew me to Bruckner's writing is her total command of the language. She's not embarrassed by her huge vocabulary. And though a meticulous user of the language, her prose is liquid and flowing. Quite by accident, the first novel I read of hers was Hotel du Lac, for which she won the Booker Prize in 1984. The lead character in that book is ironically named Edith Hope. Bruckner says that we are deceived by literature, especially Victorian novels, into the belief that virtue is rewarded. In fact, she decides, good fortune is a gift from the gods, and the favor of the gods is granted not to the good, but to the bold. In fact, very sympathetic to the French existentialists, Bruckner cannot bring herself to believe in any god, although in one of her very rare interviews she said she wishes she could, or more accurately, she would like to believe in hope. Like William James, for whom God is really simply a name for a belief that the future can be better than the past, it is hope of deliverance from loneliness and death that she would like to believe in. Like Edith Hope in Hotel du Lac, almost all of Bruckner's characters are intellectual, middle-class women who are or become isolated due to the disappointments in love. But while her characters long for mates, for men who will take care of them, they relate mostly to other women and are dismissive of men who, other than providing respectability, are seen as immature, requiring constant physical as well as emotional care, and who are ultimately more or less just in the way. Unmarried and childless herself, Bruckner has said that she had no desire to be taken over by a man, and yet many of her heroines appear to be looking precisely for that. Edith in Hotel du Lac actually has two proposals of marriage, one from a good but hopelessly dull man, and the other from a selfish adventurer whom she just manages to turn away from at the end of the book. I find Bruckner to be exceptional in her descriptions of the inner life. One commentator lauds her as being, quote, a brilliant forensic examiner of the inner life, close quote, an apt description of her powers of observation. Although she says of herself that she is not a feminist and insists that she prefers the company of men, she seems to me to be a feminist in the deepest sense of the word. Her characters are usually career women, bright and independent, even when they see themselves as seeking normalcy, that is, a lasting marriage and children. Long before becoming a novelist, in 1967, Bruckner became the first woman to hold the Slade Professorship of Fine Art at Cambridge, a position she held until her retirement in 1988. She insists that teaching and scholarship were the really important activities in her life, and that writing novels was simply a kind of dabbling, quote, displacement activity. In one of her last novels, Strangers, published in 2009, the protagonist is a 73-year-old man who has unhappily retired from his banking job and is isolated and lonely, left finally to seek comfort from strangers. Bruckner herself was 81 when she wrote Strangers, and says that like her protagonist, she feared loneliness and eventually death among strangers. Not surprisingly, two of the authors Bruckner most admires are Edith Wharton and Henry James, both masters at describing the interior life of the mind. Her female characters remind me of the strong but doomed characters in Wharton's novels, women who at least think they want love, want a man, but who find themselves unable to shape themselves, truncate themselves, in ways that seem necessary. But while Wharton's characters seem heroic in their rejection of societal pressures, Bruckner seems simply unhappy. Bruckner was the only child of Polish Jews who emigrated to England. She says that she was brought up to take care of her parents, who were transplanted and fragile people, unhappy and in need of protection. In an article in Paris Review, the interviewer, Susha Guppy, notes that all of Bruckner's heroines have a displaced person quality, and she asks if Bruckner herself feels like that. Bruckner answers that people see her as serious and depressed and admits that she has never felt completely at home in England. Indeed, after quite rapidly reading up a half dozen of her novels, intoxicated by her insights and her superb writing, I began to notice how uniformly unhappy most of her characters are. Since I have noted Bruckner's allegiance to existentialism, I want to add that I see existentialism as a cautiously optimistic philosophy, stressing rebellion and change. But I admit that some of the early works tend towards a kind of nihilism, and Bruckner seems more influenced by that darker, pessimistic side than by the stress on freedom and revolt. In her novel Brief Lives, she paints a picture of human lives as indeed short and unhappy, and quite obviously situated towards death. She is not a happy read, and yet her insights about relationships more than make up for the bleakness of her stories. I'm not surprised that one of Bruckner's best writer friends is Julian Barnes. Both are what I have called quiet writers. There's not much dramatic action in their novels, no famous people or sensational sex, as in many pop novels. I'm also reminded of other quiet writers like Alice Munro and Alice McDermott, who show just how interesting and illuminating the inner lives of so-called ordinary people are. Let me turn briefly to one of Bruckner's latest novels, The Rules of Engagement, published in 2003. Although she rarely mentions historical dates in her novels, in this novel she tells us immediately that her lead character, Elizabeth, was born in 1948, quote, well-behaved, incurious, with none of the rebellious features adopted by those who make youthfulness a permanent quest, close quote. Born to unhappy parents, Elizabeth nevertheless conforms herself to the expectations of her mother. Quote, she envisaged a life for me exactly like her own, marriage to a professional man, a comfortable establishment, licensed idleness, licensed amusements, close quote. The other major figure in the novel, also an Elizabeth, but choosing early to rechristen herself Betsy, has neither parents nor background to ensure such a safe future, and embarks on a much more adventurous life, one where career and real loves will be the goals. Married in her 20s to a much older man, Elizabeth both worries about her cousin Betsy and admires her for her freedom and courage, quoting from the book. Reading the papers, I could not help but be aware of the enormous strides women were making. They were vocal and radical in a way I knew I could never be. But there was a discontent, even among the most liberated, that I felt summoned to share. I was still young, young enough to wish for something fiercer than the life for which I had settled or to which I had succumbed, close quote. And so both Elizabeth and Betsy situate themselves in this new world. And more than in any of Bruckner's other novels that I have read, the call to liberation is heard even by these relatively conventional girls. Quote, we had both been born too soon for the freedoms currently claimed by women. We had assumed, perhaps wrongly, that safety lay in stability, that love and desire could have only one true end, marriage, and no doubt children. That this certainty was being attacked from all sides had not yet taken us over, changing us from what we had been and were still destined to be. We were innocent, like girls at school, waiting patiently for fulfillment which would come to us in the guise of another person, and not a series of more or less random persons who might or might not have our well-being at heart. Close quote. Elizabeth, unlike most of Bruckner's female characters, does decide to have a lover, to escape the tedium of her married life. She also throws over her mother's belief that, quote, a woman's principal need was to be looked after by a man, close quote. Bruckner is accused by critics of writing the same novel over and over with the same cast of colorless, unhappy people. She responds that of course she's writing the same novel, trying to finally get it right. Her writing is an attempt to be lucid, to get behind the facades of everyday life. I believe she succeeds and that her lucidity is far more important than writing happy books. I've been talking about Anita Bruckner. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Come and listen to my story, come and listen to my song. I will tell you of a hero who's now dead and gone. I will tell you of a young boy whose age was 19. He was the bravest Union man that I have ever seen. Harry Sims was a pal of mine, we labored side by side, expecting to be shot on sight or taken for a ride by them dirty coal operator gun thugs that roam from town to town, shooting down the Union men where'er they may be found. Harry Sims was walking down the track one bright sunshiny day. He was a youth of courage, his step was light and gay. He did not know the gun thugs was hiding on the way to kill our brave young comrade this bright sunshiny day.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. You've heard a bit of a couple of Pete Seeger songs, and we'll be hearing a couple more. Now Joe Clement is here to talk with our Old Mole musicologist, Brad Duncan, about the man's politics and music. But before we get to that, Old Mole Bill Resnick would like to have a word.
Hi, folks. Two brief announcements. Earlier, heard Elizabeth Teal, a Portland teacher and activist in the organization Portland Save Our Schools on the school wars in Portland. Later you will hear Kate Barnes from the High School Student Union. You can hear more from Elizabeth and the Portland Student Union at a KBOO-sponsored evening, Thursday, March 13th at the Clinton Street Theater, The evening is on the future of public education here in Portland and, in fact, around the country. It starts at 6 p.m., a panel discussion, including Elizabeth and the Student Union. At 8, we will show the film An Inconvenient Truth About Waiting for Superman. It's all free. On Thursday the 13th at 6 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater on Southeast 26th and Clinton. And one other announcement, our membership drive ended, but our need and hunger and desire for you, your support, your participation in KBOO, that did not end. It's never too late to do the right thing. Call us, 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. I'm going to answer the phone. Join the community that supports and also volunteers to make the most intelligent and fun radio on the planet. That's KBOO. You value it. Become a member. 503-231-8187.
So I'm joined with Brad Duncan, our radical musicologist. We've been covering Pete Seeger in a number of ways over the last several weeks, basically since his death. And this Wednesday at the Red and Black Cafe, there is going to be a Pete Seeger night. And so we wanted to put in one more round of talk about the tremendous life that Pete Seeger left, but in particular, the music that was really his life that came before and obviously will live after him. Thanks for joining us again, Brad.
Hey, my pleasure, as always.
So you selected a number of songs that we've listened to throughout the show, but there isn't really like any key Pete Seeger repertoire. There's just so many albums that he cut, so many songs that he played, so many festivals that he played, that these are just, you know, as good as so many other songs. I wanted to take a bit of a broad perspective and have you tell us a little bit about Pete Seeger's life and where his musical passion and politics come from.
Pete Seeger was born in 1919, and his parents were very influential people in the academic study of folk music and in the world of music more generally. His father was Charles Seeger, the ethnomusicologist, and his mother was Ruth Crawford Seeger, who was a very important, not just musicologist, but experimental musician. And a lot of their work collecting folk songs and other kind of folk music research in the early 20th century, in many ways, contributed to kind of what we think of as American folk music now. So he was born into a family of people who took American roots music very, very seriously. So we should not be surprised at all that he picks up a banjo and goes on to become a world-renowned folk singer. His half-sister Peggy Seeger and Mike Seeger, of course, went on to be very famous folk musicians, too. So it's part of his family background. And his family, he was also brought up in a family of leftists, in a family of people who, you know, were very adamant supporters of the labor movement, of civil rights, against fascism, and the people who were involved with the Communist Party, you know, from its beginning in the early 1920s. So he comes from a folk music family and a red family as well. So really so much of what we think of as Peter Seeger is really there from his youth. He starts recording in the very, very early, late 1930s and very early 40s. And his first recordings, a lot of them are with the Almanac Singers, which included Woody Guthrie, who had become very much a mentor to young Pete Seeger. Their songs that we were recording in that period, were a lot of them were related to the incredible explosion of union organizing that had happened in the 1930s and through the 40s. And so really, labor songs and songs about working class people organizing for better wages, working conditions, and ultimately for a new world. Remember, he had a red perspective and was not merely for unions, but was really for workers' power. Those themes that were with his work, you know, for decades, his whole life, those were all there from the very beginning, from his first recordings with Woody Guthrie. And ultimately, as a young folk singer in that period, he lays the groundwork for what would become the folk music revival of the 1950s and ultimately paves the way for protest songs and folk music playing such a pivotal role in the protest movements of the 1960s. Ultimately, it's Pete Seeger who most people know the song We Shall Overcome from. He didn't write the song, but he was the main popularizer of the song. So he played a tremendous role in making topical and protest songs a part of the New Left era, even though really he was a child of what we call the old left of the 1930s and 40s, but is really the archetype for the 60s as well. He goes on to become very involved with environmental activism. Again, that also features very prominently in his music in the 70s and into the 80s and 90s. And really, he ends up, for people all over the world, he is how they learn not only all of these folk songs, but he's how so many people learned about the life of a coal miner, you know, organizing for better conditions. He's how so many people learned about national independence movements that were happening in Asia and Africa. His folk songs really were a window to a world of struggle for so many people around the world.
You put it well, I think, in, you know, saying that he popularized a lot of music that came before him that wasn't his own. I mean, he wrote a number of pretty catchy, pretty compelling original tunes of his own. But for example, you know, the labor music that he channels had already, you know, been generated by working class artists for what was, you know, the 20 years prior to his involvement with the Almanacs or the Weavers.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of that would have been through the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies, and songwriters like Joe Hill, of course, which very much, you know, made up a huge percentage of the early repertoire of those singers. You're right, because that was the previous generation that laid the groundwork, you know, for the Woody Guthries and the Pete Seegers.
Word. So in the documentary that Jan and I reviewed last week, and in a lot of just kind of the memorial television coverage about him that's gone on, he, you know, there'll be mentioned that he had this communist involvement, that he was a leftist. But I think what gets more played up, even within kind of left portrayals, is that he was this true American, that there was something really deep down and originally authentic in terms of like the American Revolutionary spirit that comes through in his general hunger for justice. And we're probably going to have to tell listeners to tune into the online portion of this conversation to hear the full response that you have to give on that and anything else. But I wondered if you could go ahead and start maybe situating that image of, you know, Pete Seeger as a radical communist on the one hand, and Pete Seeger as a radical American.
Well, I'll tell you, I think in Pete Seeger in his lifetime, I think experienced quite a bit of this, where there's a concept especially powerful during the Cold War, although really you see it even in the 19th century, that the idea that the ideas of the radical left are inherently foreign and from outside the United States. I mean, that's what made Sacco and Vanzetti such, you know, perfect scapegoats for the capitalist class, because, you know, they were both foreigners and represented the left, which is this note we hear hit again and again. And so people in trying to, on the liberal left, amongst folks who kind of want to say something nice about Pete Seeger, they feel the need to kind of distance him from a tradition of the radical left. But then at the same time, there's another part of that I hear you saying, of people talking about, not in a way that smacks of, you know, kind of a Cold War whitewashing of history, but that there was something distinctly American or from the American historical experience about his vision of socialism or his, you know, vision of liberation. And I think in broad strokes, that's true, only in the sense that I think, you know, in every nation, there's different ways that a passion for justice and a hatred for injustice has manifested itself. And so, yes, I think there were some ways that Pete Seeger is uniquely American, but, you know, in the same way that Victor Jara, the great left-wing popular singer from Chile, there was so much about him that was distinctly Chilean. Ewan McCall is a distinctly British socialist folk singer. You know, Christy Moore is a decidedly Irish protest singer. And so I think in many ways that's true of Pete Seeger, that musically and in terms of maybe his artistic and political vocabulary of how he presented these ideas, and even which struggles he chose to highlight in terms of painting a picture of how things were in the world. I think in many ways they were distinctly American, but I think ultimately that's kind of part of the role that the political folk singer has played all around the world. All of the people I just mentioned, from Christy Moore to, you know, Victor Jara, all of them are, you know, important in that they bring up these universal truths about imperialism and class struggle and how we need a better world, but they do so in a vernacular and, you know, pointing to historical lessons that are nationally specific. So that's part of what was wonderful about Pete Seeger, is that there was something completely universal about him. I mean, anywhere where there's oppression, you could understand what some of Pete Seeger's songs were about. But at the same time, there was also something so undeniably American about him. I mean, you know, talk about a Yankee accent and, you know, all of the great early American folk songs that he did. So, I mean, I guess that's my take on it. He is distinctly American, but let's not get carried away, because ultimately, you know, those qualities are kind of universal and exist in all national cultures. And really, I think that's part of why Pete Seeger has resonated, you know, so much as an international figure.
I want to turn to the role that Seeger placed himself in educating Americans in the banjo and in kind of folk music production, whether it's the civil rights or whether it's of Appalachian white miners type of music. He wrote a book first in the 40s and revised it several times over the course of his life called How to Play the Five-String Banjo. Could you speak to the way that he popularized, you know, people making music for themselves as a way of empowering themselves with this communication tool, with this tool for explaining things through song?
You're right that the banjo, and especially that book, How to Play the Five-String Banjo, is so much a part of his legacy and really kind of tells us so much of his thinking on this, because he says in the book and would say throughout his life that he wanted folk music, whether it was the banjo or even group sing-alongs, which of course were a huge part of his performances, he wanted the do-it-yourself aspect of folk music to be front and center. He hated the idea that musicians, recorded professional musicians, were, you know, these extreme experts who stood above their audience, and the reason you love them was because they're their virtuosity that people like you and I could never, you know about. He knew that making music was something that everyone could do, even if everyone wasn't going to be, you know, Jimi Hendrix of their instrument, that this was an extraordinarily accessible way of people expressing themselves. And as we've talked about earlier, the fact that it's so connected to political struggles that are empowering everyday working class people is part of it, too. So he saw the banjo in many ways as being, he wanted it to be the ultimate DIY instrument that really would make a flowering of music possible amongst people who, you know, didn't go to music school. And I think it's very interesting regarding the history of the banjo. You know, an instrument that, you know, came from Africa, that's an African instrument that comes out of the African experience in the Americas. But remember, for a number of generations before the Seeger family and the folk music revival, the banjo had been really kind of co-opted by minstrelsy and by medicine shows and by entertainment that was explicitly racist. So what's also very interesting is that the banjo, through Seeger, the Seeger family, and the folk music revival, is given a whole new lease on life and a completely different cultural reading. You know, what even the sound of the banjo meant would evolve through, you know, political folk music of the 30s through the 60s. No one's ever going to think about the banjo the same way again. Whether it's just how popular it is in U.S. society or the fact that, you know, he connected it so explicitly as an accessible instrument that could be part of a grassroots flowering of real working class art, even very unprofessional art, which he loved.
We're going to have to cut this part of the conversation short, but if you tune into when this is posted online, there will be additional conversation that we're planning on having. Thanks for joining us for now, Brad.
Oh, hey, it was terrific. Always love to talk about Pete Seeger.
Now, if you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. You got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, it won't be long. You get shorter hours, better working conditions, vacations with pay, take a kid to the seashore. It ain't quite this simple, so I better explain just why you got to ride on the union train. Cause if you wait for the boss to raise your pay, we'll all be a-waiting till Judgment Day. We'll all be buried, gone to heaven. St. Peter will be the straw boss then.
And this is the OMO Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. Bill Resnick is still at our phone line. It's always the right time to become a KBOO member, and any time of day you can always bring up the KBOO webpage and click on the donations jar in the upper right-hand corner. But now Bill concludes our program today by talking with high school student Kate Barnes with a student perspective of what's ailing Portland schools. It's recorded, so he's still at the phone, 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187.
Kate Barnes, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you for inviting me.
Kate Barnes is a student at Cleveland High School. She's an activist in the Cleveland High School Student Union. In the recent contract struggle between the Portland Public Schools Administration and Portland teachers, the student union played a really important role in talking to the community, talking to parents, talking to other students, and in coordinating rallies and student walkouts supporting the teachers. Kate Barnes, congratulations about the union.
Thank you very much.
Tell us about it, how it formed, fairly briefly about its purposes and what they did in this current strike.
The way that the union formed in the beginning was there was a rally called N3, and it was for allegations of funds in the school and for against budget cuts. And I know a big group of students was there. I actually wasn't there, but they got pepper sprayed by the police. That was sort of the bonding agent that brought the union together.
Good for the police. They really are.
Yeah,
helpful.
Brought us together. Uh-huh. And then I joined about a month later, and the goal of the student union, really the main goal, is to bring a voice to the students, because why aren't we involved in making the decisions about what we're taught?
Tell us about this struggle now that, I mean, this is something that students have really gotten into. Why are you supporting the teachers? I mean, you could be supporting the administration, you know, something. We want more testing.
I don't think we're going to see any students advocating for more testing. In general, I think that teachers, because they're with us every day in the classroom, they innately care about their students. You know, and the administration and the people on the board, they aren't in the schools every day, and they aren't seeing what's going on. So how do they know our struggles? And I know the teachers union, one thing that they were fighting for that was a big deal for a lot of students was class size. And there's just so many statistics about how small classes really help improve the education of the students. So that was a big struggle. And then also the teachers were fighting for more say in determining the curriculum that they're teaching us. So while the Common Core is coming in and already we're taught around tests and around getting us to pass these benchmarks on tests, and the teachers want to have more say and want to be able to teach out of books that they choose rather than textbooks and be able to teach around conversation rather than to teach towards a test.
It really does make a difference. You do have textbooks in many of the courses.
Yeah, in a lot of classes, we are taught with mostly only the textbook. Cleveland has the IB program, so I'm in the full IB program, so I take all IB classes. And in particular, I have one history class and a great history teacher who is teaching us a lot out of Born in Blood and Fire and out of the People's History of the United States. Uh-huh. And one interesting thing we did with that was we're studying the women's suffrage movement right now, and we read the chapter in Howard Zinn's People History about women's suffrage, and he gave it at least 30 pages and a good, thorough explanation. Then we read the parody off his book, which is called A Patriot's History, and they gave it.
That's a serious book, though. It's a serious book about the real history of the United States.
They were telling the real history of the United States. It was just, they didn't like what Howard Zinn was saying, so they're telling their version. And they gave the suffrage movement 1.5 pages, I believe, maybe even a little bit less. And in the end, they seemed to turn it around to make it propaganda against Planned Parenthood, which I'm not sure how they did that, but absolutely ridiculous.
You compared the two views then of...
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing that teachers want to be able to do with their students. They'd like to teach from books that they think we can really have conversations about and that we can learn these different perspectives and different authors and not just read dry textbooks that are teaching us facts for the test.
And one thing after another, so it all becomes just numbing sorts of, like a history of the United States in the
textbooks.
It's
in one ear, out the other.
Yeah. It may help, though, for test-taking the next day after it leaves. It may last for enough time to do well enough on the test.
Yeah.
This is KBOO Radio. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Kate Barnes, who's a student at Cleveland High School, a real activist, works for the student union. Almost every high school had a walkout this year. You have chapters in many, almost every high school. But why did students, it wasn't just you who walked out. I mean, the student union, the people who are really the active, the school was supporting you. You really actually represent students.
Yes. Definitely. The way the student union works is we have a larger Portland student union, and that gets together biweekly, I'd say. And it's a group of representatives from each chapter who then go back to their schools and report back. And so the walkouts were organized by the student union and by the chapters, but we certainly saw a lot of support from all the students at our schools because contract talks and the teachers, like, it's all been on everyone's mind, and I think everyone supports the cause.
You know, it's, what's amazing, though, is that students realize that walking out was a huge threat to the schools. There's to the school board and to the governor and the president. Mm-hmm. The last thing they want is a rebellion on campuses.
Yeah.
It's real power, actually, that students have in some ways.
You know, there's actually, there's a lot of confusion around that, and there's a lot of fear around that. It takes a lot of courage to walk out of class, and I know a lot of students are unwilling to do it, but they saw that it was for a good cause, and we explained to them that it would help the cause, and that this is how we can have a voice, and this is how we can scare them and tell them that we support our teachers, and we can make movements. You know, we are big enough to change stuff if you're not going to give some leeway on this contract.
And they support you, I gather, because people understand that this testing regime is not educating them, that it's just putting huge amounts of pressure on, and it dumbs down the curriculum. And they spend a lot of time in class learning the tricks of doing a bubble test, right? And and of psyching it out and of being canny. Mm-hmm. People understand how really pathetic and terrible that is.
Generally, when I talk to students, I hear a lot of people who just want to learn and who can tell that they aren't learning much from this. They want to talk about what they're learning and have conversations about it. And it's about teaching. This is perfect slogan line that I see everywhere, but teaching people how to think rather than teaching them what to think, which is what I see. Like with the SAT, there's classes about specifically how to take the SAT, and it's not giving you knowledge, it's telling you how to take a certain test.
Yeah, it's great that students have organized. Thanks a lot for your work. That was Kate Barnes of Cleveland High School.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for being here.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? They say in Harlan County there are no neutrals there. You'll either be a Union man or a thug for J.H. Blair. Which side?
Good question. Which side are you on? Portland teachers and students, or the administrative bureaucrats. And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement has been our engineer. I want to remind listeners that the 24th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, due to snow closures, has still two more weeks to run every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night at the PCC Cascade campus. This week's film features women filmmakers, and next week we'll be showing films missed due to the snow closures of week two. For a complete schedule, just Google Cascade Festival of African Films, and it's all free, no charge to see all these great African movies. Next week on The Old Mole, Jan Hawken interviews Madeline Burroughs, who wrote Mom, Baby, God, a one-woman performance described as an undercover look at adolescence, activism, and abstinence in the pro-life movement. The national tour includes two nights in Portland, March 5th and 6th. To learn, To learn more about the play or to buy tickets, go to mombabygod.com. That's all one word, mombabygod.com. And tune in next week to learn more about the reproductive rights activism that brought this project to life. Today's program will be podcast on the KBOO website in the next day or two. You can either listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics, including an extended discussion by Joe and Brad on Pete Seeger. Just go to our webpage at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And this is KBOO 90.7 FM. Stay tuned next for Air Cascadia with Cutting Edge News, Views, and Just Plain Horse Sense with Chris Andrea. At 10:15, we'll hear Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. Today's guest is Dominic Della Sala, chief scientist with Geo Institutes in Ashland. They'll talk about Senator Ron Wyden's new proposal to double the logging on BLM lands, a bad idea on many levels.
Good morning. It's just a few seconds before 10 a.m. and you are tuned to KBOO in Portland. Coming up next, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, host Barbara Bernstein speaks with Dominic Della Sala, chief scientist with the Geos Institute, about how doubling logging on BLM lands will elevate extinction risks to threatened wildlife, pollute streams with sediment runoff, and increase global warming pollution. At 11, Grace Eagle Reed hosts Disability Awareness. The topic is living with multiple sclerosis. At 11:30, the focus is the Mount Hood Community College Creative Writing Speaker Series, which brings authors, poets, filmmakers, and scholars to the MHCC campus for a series of interdisciplinary readings and discussions. Thank you, KBOO Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support and in our recent winter membership drive. Your contributions keep KBOO on the air, and I'd like to greet the dog under my feet.
Clinton Street Theater proudly present The Inconvenient Truth Behind Waiting for Superman, a film about the public education system under fire, showing March 13th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. In recent years, standardized tests, merit pay based on test performance, and teacher union busting have been touted as some of the solutions to a stronger U.S. childhood education. The Inconvenient Truth Behind Waiting for Superman exposes the fallacy of these assumptions and explores real solutions to our country's educational challenges. After the film, teachers, parents, and students will be speaking at this event on the current crisis facing our Portland schools. That's The Inconvenient Truth Behind Waiting for Superman at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, March 13th at 7 p.m. For more information, please go to kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the page under Community Events.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Monday, February 24th, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, kboo.fm on the web, your community radio station, because it is solely owned, operated, and kept alive by your membership. It's your membership that makes all the difference in the world, 45 years now. 45 years on the air doing this. It's an amazing accomplishment. Moving right into the headlines, we're going to be speaking later on in the program with Dan Sears, with the Willamette River Keeper, on some of the issues that right now we are confronted on all sides, it seems, by the oil industry and the coal industry. All of the major players are looking at the West Coast's waterways and coasts with an eye to increasing that ever glorious bottom line. And the groups that are opposing them, from small grassroots local neighborhoods, literally communities that say, oh no, the line stops here, not on my property, to huge national groups like the Sierra Club and Greenpeace, all lining up, all together presenting a somewhat united front against these efforts to despoil what we have left of our environment. Dan Sears, with Riverkeeper, of course, is on the front lines of this struggle all the time. It's just that right now there seem to be a multiple of forces from the energy industry. And on that note, kicking off the week, we've got some very interesting collision of different, let's call them energy trains. The week starts out, West Virginia is holding a conference of bare bottom cheerleaders for Team Coal, of course. The Supreme Court is considering Obama's ideas on climate change. The EPA is law. This is like challenging Obamacare business. It's already a law. Every time anything comes up regarding an EPA regulation, the right is going to challenge it. And that's what we're seeing right now. Utilities industry is upset because, wait for it, too many Americans have noticed that solar energy is the cheapest energy there is once you get the architecture of it up and running and off the ground. So eyes on energy this week, because when you've got three events like that, conference in West Virginia, EPA and the Supreme Court, the utilities industry is upset because they're not making profits like they used to, all because of these degenerates who've opted for solar energy. In Jackson County, voters this May will vote on a proposed ban on GMO crops. Strangely enough, the state's campaign disclosure database, whereupon one might go to look for more information about this. Strangely enough, it suffered a mysterious cyber attack on February 4th. As of this weekend, it's back up. But meanwhile, agribusiness interests have been busy raising money, most of it for a massive out-of-state Monsanto-like substances. More on that later. And Washington Governor Jay Inslee is still fighting the good fight to preserve the state's waiver from provisions of the federal No Child Left Behind. The next windmill, of course, will be the core curriculum. You think we could get this right, you know?